Last year, in the middle of the summer, gardeners were dealing with triple-digit temperatures and low moisture. But lately, cool temperatures have been the reality. So how does that treat your vegetable garden? And how should you assess your garden's progress so far? It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Stanton, and for Charity Nebbe, it's Friday, Horticulture Day. We'll be starting the program talking with Ajay Nair, Iowa State University Extension Vegetable Production Specialist. We'll talk with him about how, once again, the unique series of weather conditions in Iowa are affecting the lawn and garden. We'll hear a little about new research he's doing and talk about the upcoming Fruit and Vegetable Field Day at the Horticulture Research Station in Ames. And ISU Extension Horticulture Specialist Richard Duran is also here to answer your plant questions. Join the conversation after this news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Ben Stanton, in for Charity Nebbe. Horticulture Day today on the program. That means we'll be answering your questions about your lawn and garden. And our experts are here to do just that. You can give us a call. You can visit our Facebook page, send an email. Joining us in just a minute will be Richard Duran, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist. But first, I want to introduce Ajay Nair, ISU Extension Vegetable Production Specialist. He's joining us in our Ames studio. Ajay, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Ben.
Well, glad to have you on the program, and I should say welcome back to Talk of Iowa. You've been on several times in the past.
That's right.
And I remember about this time last year, you were on, and the discussion sure centered on the hot weather, the dry weather, and I guess we've had drier conditions here compared to this spring, but can you talk about the weather compared especially to last year? It sure seems like a different picture.
Yeah, Ben, you're correct. You know, last time when I was here, you know, there were more issues with heat and drought and water issues, but this time I think we have both on our plate because we started pretty wet in the growing season, and things were planted a little late, especially commercial vegetable growers. They had issues to get into their fields and till their ground and lay the plastic mulch. So things started at a slower pace, but I believe the dry weather for the past almost two weeks, you know, it has kind of accelerated the growth of a lot of crops. And now we are kind of in a situation where we need the rain. But especially with the vegetable growers, since most of the production is on black plastic mulch with drip irrigation, I believe growers manage their irrigation pretty well and their crops are doing pretty good in the state.
Well, talk a little bit about, you mentioned that some people have planted late. How does that fit into then this cooler weather? I know some plants need that heat to grow. Are there plants that maybe thrive better and we say cooler temperatures, highs in the upper 70s, lower 80s. It's not cold, but it's cooler than 100.
Yeah, I think with the cool beginning of the season, this time growers had a great luck growing peas. They did pretty well with a lot of leafy vegetables in the spring. They did pretty good. Usually, you know, peas, we have issues with the heat starting early. Their yields start to decline. You have issues with disease. But this time, the peas, they did great, really well. Same with, fall in the spring, they planted some of the other kohl crops, kohlrabi. That did pretty well in the spring. And now, you know, with the heat coming, it's actually helping some of the summer crops, such as, you know, watermelon that needs a lot of heat and sunshine. We have some projects here ongoing at the ISU Research Farm on sweet potatoes, which are lagging a little behind as compared to last year because they also absolutely love the heat. So the melons and your cucurbit, the squashes, they kind of love the heat and they are kind of taking advantage of the situation. They might have been a little slow, like the harvest of the cucumber. Usually you harvest cucumber every 3 or 4 days, but because of the cool weather, we were harvesting maybe once a week. So the number of harvests would remain the same at the end of the season, but the interval between them is a little different.
That's right. Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the research that you've done recently. And I want to talk about something I had not heard about that's mm-hmm. called biochar. Can you explain what that is?
Oh, sure. Yeah. There is a growing interest in using this product called biochar. So to define biochar, it is nothing but thermal decomposition of organic material under low temperatures. When I say low temperature, it's below 700 degrees Celsius. and under limited supply of oxygen. So when you burn the biomass in these conditions, the char which you get is biochar. And the objective of developing or creating biochar is to add it to the soil as an amendment and improve the quality of the soil in terms of water retention, in terms of nutrient retention, increasing the cation exchange capacity, and also to reduce the amount of nitrates that flow down through the soil and into our water table. And biochar is not new to Iowa, because a lot of my colleagues in the agronomy department, Dr. David Laird, and Dr. Brown at the BioCentury Farm, they have been looking at biochar and incorporating it into corn and soybean production systems, and they have found some advantages and some benefits. The use of biochar in vegetable production system is something new. Not much research has been done in the Midwest looking at incorporating different rates of biochar and see how the vegetables grow. You know, how does the soil differ? How does the quality of the vegetable come out at the end of the season?
And it's people like you that are looking into that and seeing how it does work, I know. But again, we're talking with Ajay Nair. He's ISU Extension Vegetable Production Specialist. It's Horticulture Day today. And we're talking about biochar. I want to back up and talk. I did a Google image search, Ajay, of biochar, and I wanted to try to describe it to people that hadn't seen it. So what you're describing is you burn organic material, and it does. It looks like what you might have left over after a campfire goes out.
So what is left over after a campfire goes out, that's very different. That's ash. It has very little organic carbon in it. It's more minerals, because the campfire is burning in the presence of oxygen. Biochar is a process used called pyrolysis, which is burning of the organic matter in the limited oxygen environment. So the product which comes out would actually depend upon how you make the biochar, the temperature, the duration you burn it. But biochar can be obtained in different sizes. So you can get biochar in the size of regular charcoal, which we use for our camping and other recreation purposes. And it can go, and it can, the size can keep going down, and you get biochar in the size of the perlite or the vermiculite, which you add in your growing mixes. And you can even get biochar in the form of powder, which by the time even you scoop from the bucket or the bag, it will be just up in the air. So we try to work with the size which can be easily manageable and could be easily incorporated in the soil. So something like the vermiculite or the perlite, that's the size of the biochar.
Are you, now, this biochar, is this something that your everyday backyard gardener is finding and using, or is this for a larger scale?
As I said, research has been done in the agronomy department and this BioCentury Farm of looking at biochar in row crops such as corn and soybean. But my colleague and even Richard is working with Dr. Cindy Haynes, and they have been working with master gardeners and trying to look at small, limited applications of biochar in a home yard, you know, home grower setup. And they have certain plots set up at different research stations, and they're growing ornamentals in there. And so, as I said, you know, there's a lot of interest. A lot of people are trying to use it in small amounts and quantities and see how it affects their crop. But we need to do more research to see how actually it affects the soil. How is the biology of the soil changing? Or is it tying onto the nutrients too much and it's not available to the plant? So a lot of questions that need to be addressed. But it's good to see that, you know, people have caught onto it and they want to try it and see how their crops and their ornamental plants do.
Sure. Well, let's go back to some research that you've done in the past, and this was over the past few years, and I know that it took several years to complete, as I'm sure much of your research might need to do if you go through many growing cycles. But you looked at tomato plants and finding out, correct me if I'm mischaracterizing it, but looking at the biological state of affairs underground and where you'll be planting tomato plants and using rye as cover crops and some other things. Can you describe that research?
Yeah, sure. So the primary focus of my research and extension program is looking at how can we improve the soil. Not that we have to improve. The Iowa soils are already pretty good with almost 3.5 or even 5% organic matter. But we need to sustain this. And to sustain this, we need to think of strategies by which we can build the soil, by which we can stimulate the biology in the soil, we can hold on to the nutrients in the soil, we can reduce leaching, reduce erosion. So cover crops is one of the tool for sustainable production. And what we are doing is we are focusing on two different type of cover crops. One which a lot of growers in Iowa are familiar with is the use of rye and hairy vetch at the end of the growing season. So they would go and seed the cover crops. Let's say September, the rye will grow, it will suppress weeds, it will reduce erosion, it will go dormant in the winter, and the spring it will come back. It will take up all the nitrogen which was left over in the soil in the fall. And you till the cover crop in the spring, and you grow your vegetables or any other crop you want to. So that's a typical cover crop which most of the growers practice in the fall. Now, a niche which I want to focus on, and we are still working on it, is to develop or use cover crops that can be used by vegetable growers who do not who have a very short window to grow their crop, and who might have certain durations in their field where they do not put anything. So let's say as a vegetable grower, they were growing lettuce or some other leafy greens in the spring, or even peas. And then in the summer, they have a 1 month or 45-day window where their field remains fallow. They don't do anything. And then they are planning to grow cabbage or broccoli in the fall. So for this 1.5 month or 30-day window, what cover crop can we grow? And there are certain cover crops we are working with. Some are in the brassica family, such as yellow mustard, oilseed radish, brown mustard. We are also looking at other alternative crops such as buckwheat, sorghum Sudan grass, and those are short-duration crops which a grower can seed and can terminate the cover crop in like 45 days. And by doing that, they build the organic matter in the soil. They take up the nutrients which were in the soil and put it back, recycle it. And weed suppression, we have found excellent results working with growers in different areas, in Boone, in Mount Vernon, where we used buckwheat as a great resource to suppress weeds. So in a plot where there is buckwheat, you come back after 45 days, you remove the cover crop and look inside, there's absolutely no weed growing. And when you compare that with a control plot where you did not have any cover crop, it'll be just, you know, covered with weeds. So we are trying to see how can we study more of these summer short duration cover crops.
Ajay Nair, we're going to be taking a short break here, but quickly, you have a field day coming up. Just tell us where and when and what it's for.
Yes, this is an annual event. This is the 2013 Fruit and Vegetable Field Day. That's going to happen at the Horticulture Research Station in Ames. And we will be showcasing different research projects. There'll be grower interaction, IFVGA, and the Practical Farmers of Iowa, the NRCS. A lot of organizations are coming together. So we hope to have a good turnaround.
Ajay Nair is ISU Extension Vegetable Production Specialist. We'll be joined by Richard Duran in a moment. We're taking your calls and your questions. Call us 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Back in a few minutes. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Stanton, in for Charity Nebbe. Horticulture Day today, we're taking your calls at 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Still with me is my guest, Ajay Nair, Iowa State University Extension Vegetable Production Specialist. And we're joined now also by Richard Duran, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist. Thank you both for being here.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, glad to have you on the show, and we're going to get to some calls here in just a minute, but I want to make sure we have the contact information out there again, 1-866-780-9100. Send us an email, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. You can tweet us, @IPRTalk, or, what am I forgetting, tweet, phone number. There's also email, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Well, let's go to Mark in Dubuque. Mark.
Hello, good morning.
Hi there. Go ahead.
Say, I've got hostas all around my yard, and they're beautiful looking and everything, but here's my question. They flower, and when they flower, the flower is a lavender flower, and mm-hmm. they're like a 48-inch stem or stalk coming out, and they don't look so good that way. I'm wondering, when they flower and these long stems and they hang over the border and everything and they look bad, can I cut those off of there without damaging that plant?
Absolutely. If you don't like the appearance, you can cut them off. No problem at all.
That's it then. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks for the call, Mark. Appreciate
Bye-bye.
It. Okay, let's go to George in Mason City. George.
Well, hello. Good
Hi.
Morning.
Go ahead.
I have an odd question for you about peonies. And my mother couldn't answer it, so I know it's odd. I have a row of peonies that have not been touched since we moved here 11 years ago. But last year, one of the peony plants came up sort of miniaturized. It didn't flower. And this year, a second peony plant is doing the same thing, and it's actually started in on a third. It's like halfway through a third plant. Now, the plants are still there, but I'm just wondering, it's not an herbicide that we can figure out. Dogs aren't using that as their particular place. Is there anything underneath that could be eating these guys? Because it's going progressively down a row.
I don't think there's anything per se eating it.
Uh-huh.
I guess I would be concerned maybe there's some type of root rot or crown rot where you're getting some major root damage or crown damage weakening the plant. Are these in a well-drained soil?
You know, I hadn't thought of it particularly that. I mean, there are probably 15 other peony plants within 10 feet of these.
Okay. The reason I asked that is because over the last several years, we've had some very, very wet years.
Uh-huh.
And if they're in a poorly drained site with our above normal rainfall, maybe some of the soils stayed too wet.
Huh. And it is off the driveway, so possibly.
And if you have very wet conditions, those conditions favor things like root rots or possibly a crown rot. And so I kind of suspect that they have some type of rotting problem.
Okay.
There's not much you can do about that.
Should I lift them and move them somewhere else? I know that lifting them will set them back again.
Right. Well, if I thought they were in a wet, poorly drained site, I would consider moving them in September, where you dig them up and transplant them. It may take a couple years for them to recover,
yes.
But typically they would. Just make sure they have at least 6 hours of direct sun, and they do have a fertile, well-drained soil, and hopefully they would recover. If they don't, I guess I would be inclined to maybe dig them up and destroy them because they may have some type of disease.
Yeah, okay. Very good.
Thanks for the call, George. Good luck.
Well, thank you. Yeah. Bye-bye.
Bye now. You can call us at 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. Go to our Facebook page, Iowa Public Radio. You can tweet us at IPR Talk or send us an email, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Marty is in Iowa City. Marty. Go ahead. Are you there, Marty?
Yes, I am.
Okay, go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay, first question, blackberries. I got some black satin thornless, and they are so sour, we can't eat them. Should I just take them out and throw them away?
Well, if they're not edible, I would basically just toss them. Make sure they have adequate moisture when the actual berries are forming. Sometimes if they're dry, you may not get a very good taste, but if they're not edible, I would just go ahead and toss them.
The other one is tree peonies. I've had them for maybe 5 or 6 years, and I think they got really, really dry last with the drought, and there's a lot of turning brown. And can I just prune those down pretty far?
I would only prune back what is completely dead.
Okay.
Something that is still partially alive, I would keep.
Okay.
Because you don't want to remove foliage that can manufacture food and feed the plant, so you don't want to do that. But anything that's basically bare that is dead, you can prune out. What you might want to do is, I think in recent weeks it has gotten dry in many parts of Iowa, And if you have a plant that you suspect is maybe not very healthy, I would go ahead and water maybe every week to 10 days to make sure it has moisture, because the last thing you want is for that plant to deal with hot, dry conditions.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I enjoy the program.
Yeah, thank you for the call, Marty. See if we can go to Art in Edgewood. Art, go ahead.
Hi. I've got a fairly large garden here in town, and the soil is very, very sandy, and I'm always trying to add compost to it and such as that. And on NPR sometime this past winter, I heard of a technique where they would plant a cover crop in the fall and then in the spring kill that crop and plant in slits rather than covering. Do you know anything about that and have any recommendations if you do?
So, Art, I think what you're talking about is strip tillage. That's one way when we use cover crops and we plant in strips. But in that case, we do not mow the cover crop or till the cover crop in. So the strip tillage, the technique which we follow, mostly in commercial production systems, I have a few growers I work with who grow pumpkins. Daryl Giesler is one of them. He's part of IFVGA. He's doing strip till pumpkins. And what we do is we seed the cover crop, mostly rye, in August, September. The rye will grow till winter, becomes dormant, and it again grows back in the spring. And then you can kill the cover crop in two ways. Either you can spray Roundup, a synthetic way of killing, or organic growers or sustainable growers, what they would do is they would roll the rye down. So there's a roller crimper. It's a huge roller, about 10 feet wide. We fill it with water and very heavy, and we hook it onto a tractor and just roll over the cover crop. So the roller kills the cover crop. Rye is all flat down. And then you come with a tiller called strip tiller. And what it does, it just creates those small channels, about 12 inches wide, a foot wide, in the debris, in the cover crop debris. And you plant within that. So by doing that, you are not disturbing the entire plot. You're not disturbing the soil. You're just disturbing the soil where you are tilling. So this is a conservation form of tillage where you conserve the soil, improve soil biology because the rye roots are still in the soil and then they feed the microorganisms. But usually it is practiced in bigger scales. You can do that if you can put a cover crop there and you have means to roll it down or terminate the cover crop and then just make strips in it and plant within that.
And then the soil is then tilled after the crop is harvested and then replant the cover.
That's correct. Once we harvest the vegetable crop, we come back and just till the entire ground. Everything is tilled in, and then if you want to plant back, you can do that again. Now, with rye, you have to be careful is that if you're not going the strip-till route and you are just tilling everything, the cover crop in the spring, and then you are planting, you should not immediately plant. You should wait for at least 10 to 14 days because the rye has some allelochemicals which can suppress the germination of the vegetable crop you are putting. If you're putting seed, it will definitely affect. If you're using transplants, it will slow down the growth. So once the cover crop is finished in the spring, you till it under the soil. If you're not following strip till, if you're completely tilling it in, wait for about 10 to 14 days and then plant your vegetable crop.
Would buckwheat be a suitable alternative for that process?
Buckwheat will not overwinter in Iowa. It will winter kill. So you won't have a thick mat like how you have with rye. So buckwheat would be more just a small duration cover crop for 45 days. And you do not want the buckwheat to seed. You have to terminate the buckwheat, otherwise it will seed and it will become weed for you. So it will defeat the purpose.
Okay.
Hope that helps, Art. Thanks for the call. Yep. Thank you. You can call 1-866-780-9100. That's 1-866-780-9100. You can also post on our Facebook page. Let's go to a Facebook post from Jessica. My pumpkin vines looked really good, but suddenly some got yellow-brown edges on their leaves and things went rapidly downhill from there. A whole long branch of vine will be dead quickly. My cucumbers did the same thing, but the vines died faster within 24 hours. She has big green pumpkins coming, and she's worried she's going to lose them. What should she do?
So with the cucumbers, if the vines died by just collapsing, if it looks like the water was completely lost and the leaves just drooped, it's more because of the bacterial wilt. which is spread by cucumber beetles. So the decline is quick. You know, within 1 day, the crop will just sag down, and then slowly it will just be out. With the pumpkins, it seems usually, you know, you have the vine borers, but that's typically affecting squash, the squash vine borer, which can affect the, which can also lead to the quick decline. You might also want to look at the leaf, how the leaves of the pumpkin look like. Are there yellow spots on the leaves, like yellow halo regions on the leaves?
Yeah,
It's on Facebook. Sorry. Sorry, Ben. I thought it was the
That's
light.
Okay. Well, yeah, so, I think that should help.
If there were some yellow spots on, you know, I got some cases in which there were some downy mildew in some cucurbits. Mm-hmm. So this could be downy mildew. The plant really goes down pretty quick. It becomes yellow soon. That could also be one of the cases.
Well, let's answer quickly an email that someone wanted to know again about the field day, when and where. That's, I believe, Monday, August 12th at the Horticulture Research Station in Ames. Is that right?
That's correct,
Ajay?
Ben. And it starts at 1:30 p.m.
Okay.
And this time the format is a little different. It's not just the field day. We have a couple of presentations on particular research topics. And after we finish that, that starts from 2 to almost 3:30, 4, and 4 o'clock, we load onto our wagons and we go to each research project. We look at the crop which is ongoing there, research ongoing there. We have some results we will share. And then in the evening, there is some downtime where the growers can just mingle with the researchers within themselves. And we are grilling some good food. And the growers want to go back into the field and take a look, take pictures, ask more questions. So it'll be more relaxing time in the evening.
Okay, sounds nice. That's Ajay Nair, ISU Extension Vegetable Production Specialist. We're also talking with Richard Duran, ISU Extension Horticulture Specialist. And we're taking your calls. Let's go to Steve in Cedar Rapids.
Hey, we've got a couple of hydrangea planted out in front of the house. One of them is white, and it blooms and does great every year. The other one is a blue hydrangea. It was a fairly young plant. We moved into the home 10 years ago, and it did have some blue flowers on it, some blooms on it. But then ever since then, it has grown into a really nice plant, but it never flowered. I mean, it didn't flower in any way, shape, or form. Not only were they not blue, there just weren't any blooms there at all.
Okay.
And then last year, we bought another blue hydrangea, and the other one bloomed. And we jokingly said, well, it must have known that its days were short, and it decided to bloom. So we thought the problem was taken care of, and this year, the same thing has happened. Now we have absolutely no blooms on it.
Okay.
Very healthy plant, but, you know, foliage-wise, but no blooms.
Does it die back quite a bit in late winter?
No, it seems to do quite well. I mean, compared to the other hydrangea, okay. It looks just fine, but then it just does not bloom.
Okay. Well, the big leaf hydrangeas basically bloom on, for the most part, last year's growth. And in Iowa, if they die back extensively in winter, they typically don't bloom. They'll grow back, but they typically won't bloom because last year's growth has been destroyed. So many of the older varieties, like Nikko Blue, for example, does not bloom very reliably in Iowa. It very seldom blooms in Iowa. In the last few years, they've introduced a lot of new varieties, like Endless Summer, which is a very common variety. And that variety will bloom both on new wood and old wood. So if that variety winter kills extensively and you lose last year's growth, it still comes back and then blooms typically in late summer. So if I were planting a big leaf hydrangea, I would buy one like Endless Summer that blooms on both new wood and old wood. And as far as
now, should we be doing any cutting back on it at all in the fall?
Only prune out the dead wood in late winter, early spring. If you have some dead wood, prune that out. That's all you have to do. And
okay.
If you don't have much dead wood at all, just leave it. Now, I will say that the big leaf hydrangeas also would like to have around 4 to 6 hours of direct sun. So some varieties or some types prefer less sun. But they typically like maybe 4 to 6 hours of sun. And I would typically put them where they have maybe an eastern exposure rather than a southern or western exposure. because the eastern site is typically a little bit cooler, and they kind of like that. So, and they also need to be well watered when it's dry. They will wilt very quickly if they're dry. So,
it may be normal that this thing has only produced a bloom once in the last 10 years.
Right. It may be the fact that it's a variety that blooms strictly on last year's growth, and it may only be blooming after a mild winter where you have very little winter kill. If we have a typical winter where you get temperatures maybe 10 or 20 below zero, you're probably getting pretty extensive dieback, and therefore it's not blooming.
All right. Would it help to cover it in the winter?
Well, you could try that, where you go out maybe in November and take some soil and kind of mound up around the plant and maybe cover the bottom 6, 7, 8 inches of the shoots and see if that helps.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the call, Steve. Appreciate it. Good luck. Well, we're going to be taking a break here in just a minute on the program. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. You can give us a call at 1-866-780-9100. Again, 1-866-780-9100. Send us an email, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Or you can send a tweet at IPR Talk. Visit our Facebook page, post your question, we'll read it on the air. Richard Duran and Ajay Nair will be with us here again for the remainder of the program, answering your calls. Stay with us. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Stanton, and for Charity Nebbe. Horticulture Day today, we're answering your questions. Our guests today are Richard Duran, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist, also Ajay Nair, Iowa State University Extension Vegetable Production Specialist, and they're answering your questions. Let's go back to the phones. First, I should give out the number one more time, 1-866-780-9100. It's 1-866-780-9100. And let's see if we can go to Bill in Des Moines. Bill,
hi,
go ahead.
I'm going to make these real quick.
Okay.
I come up with the other question after I heard other callers. Number one question is, I have a Japanese maple that was planted last year by a nursery, and the bottom branches were obviously, you know, meant they didn't prune them off or nothing because they look like they're pretty healthy. Now this year they got really healthy, and they're pretty low to the ground, and they're about ready to, I have to prop them up to keep them from touching the ground because I want to mow around it. And somebody was telling me I should prune those off, and because they claim that it's about 10 feet high now that it's at its height. What do you think?
Well, I would maybe leave them for another year or so, just until that tree is well established, and then maybe prune those off.
How tall do they get?
It depends upon the cultivar, but I would say probably 10 to 15 feet is maximum.
Okay.
But I'd probably wait, maybe leave them on another year, maybe next year.
Okay.
And then take them off the following year in late winter, early spring.
Okay. So another question, the hydrangea thing, I just planted one this year. And I was just wondering, do you chop it all the way down in the wintertime? Chop it down to a little bit above the, you know, ground?
It really depends upon which one it is. There are several different types of hydrangea. If you have the common, let's say, Annabelle hydrangea that grows 3 to 4 feet in height, and that's it, and blooms in mid to late summer, that one you can cut back in late winter, early spring, right back to the ground. It will grow back and bloom.
Okay. One last thing real quick. I tore out these lilac bushes, and I threw wildflowers, and the little suckers keep on popping up all the time, and I keep on breaking them, and, man, they grow like crazy. And I was wondering, is there anything I can do to them permanently so they don't keep on growing?
Well, basically, you have two options. One is to dig them up, physically dig them up, remove them.
Oh.
I guess the other option would be to cut them off and apply Roundup directly to the cut surface.
Okay.
Because you have to basically destroy any remaining roots. Because if there are roots still in the soil that are alive, they will sucker or send up shoots.
Yeah, well, these roots are obviously pretty deep growth. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thanks for the call, Bill. Appreciate it, and good luck with that. Let's go to Jody in Johnston. Jody, go ahead.
Yes. My husband and I, planted a red Bartlett pear tree last fall in late October. We bought it from a nursery in town, and it was about a 4 or 5 year old tree already. So this year, this is our first year with it fruiting, and there's about 50 to 60 pears on it. It's not a terribly large tree. It's probably only about 10 foot tall at the highest point. And just in the last week or so, the pears have gotten quite a bit bigger, and all the branches are starting to droop, I think, from the weight of the fruit.
Right.
So I don't have a lot of experience with fruit trees other than my grandmother's backyard that had 40-year-old pear trees that didn't need pruning anymore. So I'm not really sure. Do we need to, like, selectively pick some of these pears now so that the tree doesn't risk breaking?
Yes, you do, which is kind of a hard thing to do. But basically, if they have too much, the danger is that they're going to get so heavy, they're going to break some of the branches. And
so do we pick like a certain size and then anything below that size we take off, or do we take off all of them to save the tree this year and wait for next year?
I would examine those. And if you see any fruit that appear to be damaged, they come off first. Let's say they've been damaged by hail or insects.
And we have a few that have bug spots.
Yeah, right. So I would remove those that appear to have suffered damage. Okay. And if you do that and you still have quite a few left, then I would probably do some selective removal. And basically when you're done, you should have a fruit about every 8 inches on the branches.
There's a lot more than that right now.
I know. It's going to be hard to do. And in the future, you really should do this typically in early June when they're quite small.
Right after they start to form. Okay.
Right. Commercial growers, they actually go out there and they have a chemical thinner that they spray on the trees, and they do it that way. A homeowner basically has to do it physically by hand thinning of the fruit. But at this point, I would just go out, look for any damaged ones, take those off, and then kind of selectively take off some of the other ones too.
Okay, Jody,
okay, so
thanks.
So it should be probably about 40% of them need to go away then?
Well, possibly more. But you want to have about one fruit every 8 inches on the branch approximately.
Thanks for the call, Jody. Appreciate it. And good luck. I like your problem. Two fruitful fruit trees. That's okay. Nothing wrong with that. Let's go to Donna in Sumner. Donna, go ahead.
Hi. I have a very large lavender plant. It's been in the ground, the same spot for several years. And I'd like to know if I can divide it either this fall or in the spring. And if so, what do I need to know to do that?
Well, lavender is kind of finicky in Iowa, actually. And oftentimes they tend to die out on a regular basis. So you're lucky. You're very fortunate. As far as dividing it, I would do that next spring if it survives the winter, because winter typically can be a very difficult time for lavender in Iowa. So I would leave it undisturbed this fall and winter. And then if it survives the winter in very good shape, then I would go out there probably in April and dig it up and divide it.
And so I need to dig up the entire plant and then divide it.
Yeah, I think I would. I think it's easier to do it that way than try to simply remove a portion of it. I would dig up the whole thing and then take like a butcher knife or a sharp knife and simply divide it and replant it.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Don. Appreciate it. I want to go to a couple emails here. This from Angela in Iowa City. I have 4 early girl tomato plants that have been producing some great tasting tomatoes for us. Some of the fruit have been having issues. At the beginning of the picking season, there were some tomatoes that were molded just on the bottom of the fruit. She kept an eye on them afterward to pick earlier to avoid the mold, but she noticed a light brown circular patch on the bottom of the tomatoes, which then developed the mold quickly. So, Richard, sounds like you know what that is.
That's blossom end rot. It's very, very common on tomatoes, especially early on in the season, like late July, early August. It's actually caused by a calcium deficiency. The best way to avoid that is to water on a regular basis when it's dry, so maybe every 6-7 days when it's dry. There's typically no need to add calcium to the soil. There's typically plenty there. The problem usually is when we have uneven moisture supplies, the plants have a difficult time absorbing enough calcium. And it takes, when you have a blossom on a tomato plant, it takes typically 50 days for that to grow and then ripen. That's a long time. And oftentimes we have dry periods as far as weather-wise, and that's where you run the problem. So I would also pick those off that have those because they're typically going to rot anyway. Mm-hmm. And I don't want the plant wasting its energy on something that's going to rot I can't use.
Right. Yeah. Well, go ahead, Ajay.
Yeah, and Ben, just to add on, it can also happen to leafy vegetables because of the calcium deficiency. You see this symptom called the leaf tip burn, where the edges of the leaves become brown and they just kind of burn. So head lettuce, it becomes completely non-marketable if you have leaf tip burn on that. And that calcium, the mechanism which Richard just mentioned, it's the same principle behind it. Irregular watering, so the calcium doesn't move evenly, and then you see that symptom. So it is applicable to other vegetables as well.
Okay, thank you to Angela for that email question. Let's go back to the phones and go to Jeff in Dubuque. Jeff, go ahead. What's your question?
I actually have two questions.
Well, pick your favorite. We only have time for one.
Okay. I have a clover that reoccurs in my grass every year. And I'm wondering, I've tried to fertilize it and with like a weed and feed, and it kills it off, but it comes back every year.
Jeff, I think the clover which is coming back is the white clover, or also known as the Ladino clover. And that clover is a perennial clover, so the average lifespan would be like 4 to 5 years. It could be, other clovers such as, let's say, red clover or Berseem clover. Red will come back for 2 years, but let's say the Berseem or the Crimson, they do not overwinter. So I think it could be the white clover. It could be alfalfa too.
I'm guessing white clover would be my guess. Mm-hmm. It's fairly common in lawns, and usually it tends to occur in soils or areas that are low in fertility. And so one strategy is to maybe fertilize on a regular basis. And as far as the lawn is concerned, you could fertilize in September. You can fertilize in late October, early November. You can fertilize in spring. We typically don't fertilize during the summer months of June, July, and August. You can also put on a broadleaf herbicide in the fall. I would use a combination product that has or contains two or three different compounds. They tend to be very effective. And if you do those two things where you fertilize the lawn, you encourage a very thick, dense turf, and then use a broadleaf herbicide, you should be able to get rid of most of it.
I hope that helps, Jeff. Thanks for the call. Appreciate that. Let's go to Raj in West Des Moines.
This is it. This is she. Oh, hey, thanks for taking my call. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Go ahead. What's your question?
So, I have a honey locust tree. So we got a couple of honey locust tree, mm-hmm. and one we put on the east side of the house. It's doing great.
Okay.
Its partner was put on the west side, where I think it gets too much water from the sprinklers of my neighbor as well as ours. So the three trees that were on the west side started dying, and when I dug up the old trees, it was just sitting in water.
Oh.
So I was like, oh my gosh, I'm going to lose this honey locust. So I dug it up 2 weeks ago, and I put it close to its partner. Now, this has not even budded out. It didn't bud out in the spring, or maybe it did a little bit, but I think there was too much water. I was afraid of losing it. I moved it 10 days ago.
Okay.
When do I throw in the towel? I go up to it every day, and I talk to it, and I keep my fingers.
Okay. So it hasn't had a leaf all this year?
It did have a leaf when we first put it in, but that's when the sprinklers were not on yet.
And that was this spring or last year?
Was this spring.
This spring. But it's been basically bare since?
Since, I'd say, what, April, March?
Okay, April, March.
Yeah.
I would have to think that it's dead at this point.
Okay.
What I would do is I would go out there and take one of those branches and bend it. And if it's dead, it's going to be dry, it's going to be brittle, it's going to snap, okay? If you bend it sharply and it doesn't break, it's still pretty limber, then I would leave it. But I would say there's a very, very good chance, maybe 95% or more, that tree is dead, basically, I'm afraid.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Well, I scratched the bark off, and it's still green.
Okay.
And I did the branch breaking thing. One branch broke, and the other one looks like it's fairly supple.
Right.
But it's definitely gone?
Yeah, I think so. A tree has to leaf out at some point in the summer, and it just cannot sit there leafless most of the growing season. So I would think the likelihood is it's basically dead. Okay. Now, on this other site, if it's a wet site, you might want to look at some trees that, like wet soils.
Okay.
For example, bald cypress.
Okay, those are those two that I have in mind. And I also got a river birch.
Okay, okay.
Okay.
So both those trees like moist to wet soil, so good
now,
idea.
Do I have to do something to the soil to improve the drainage before I put these, you know, wet-loving trees in?
No, you shouldn't have to. They can, the bald cypress, we have some on campus. They're very attractive trees. They do very well in wet to moist soils. They do tolerate dry conditions pretty well, too. So I don't see a great need to do anything. Now, when you plant, make sure you don't plant too deep. But beyond that, I think you're fine.
Thanks for the call, Raj. And I'm sure that's not what you wanted to hear about your tree. But don't let that keep you from continuing to talk to your plants. I think that's probably a good thing. Somehow it's helpful. Let's go to Jessica in Marshalltown. Jessica.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Hi. I'm a really big fan of planting unconventional plants such as purslane and lamb's quarters and that kind of thing as a food source. And I'm very aware that they're all on the Iowa noxious weed list. And I was just curious as to whether some of my neighbors who don't exactly like these plants could call and report me for growing these.
I don't believe purslane is on the noxious plant list per se. There are a number of things that are. For example, some of the thistles, some of those are definitely on the noxious weed list. But I don't think purslane is. Purslane is just a very common weed. It's very, very common, but I don't think it's on the noxious weed list. There actually are some ornamental purslanes that we grow as ornamentals. They have very attractive flowers. It's a very well-adapted weed in that it grows real low and it produces a lot of seeds. So it's a well-adapted weed to Iowa.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, thanks for the call, Jessica. I appreciate that. Let's squeeze in one more call here. Let's go to Dave in Anamosa. Dave, go ahead.
Say, I got a 2,000-square-foot garden. For the winter, I put on a winter rye as a cover crop. Now, next year, I'm not going to be planting anything there at all. So the year after that, how would I... Would I have to mow this down, or how should I handle that?
So, Dave, rye is a very typical cover crop used here in the winter. So next year, what I would do is I would to easily incorporate it and till it in the soil. I will mow it first and then come with the tiller and then just till the cover crop in. That would be my approach. I would not till it or mow it before it has reached its reproductive phase, because otherwise it just keeps growing back. So when you see that the rye is at anthesis, you will see the pollens right about the time when the pollens start flying, you can mow it and incorporate it in.
Okay. Does that help, Dave?
Yep, that'll be fine. Thank you.
Okay, very good. Well, thank you for the phone call there, Dave. And I want to also thank my guest today, Ajay Nair, Iowa State University Extension Vegetable Production Specialist. And thank you very much, Ajay, for being here.
Thank you very much, Ben. If I have a quick second to let you know about the website where people can register for the field day, it's www.aep.iastate.edu/hort, H-O-R-T.
Okay, thank you. And Richard Giron, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist, thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, and Sarah Bowden. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio Talk Shows is Catherine Perkins. Technical assistance today from Sean McLean in Ames. Horticulture Day will be back again next Friday. For Charity Nebbe, I'm Ben Stanton. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.